This is Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
JBL Tour Pro 3 earbuds are for those who don't conform to the standard.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to get into some touchscreen technology, how about the smart charging case, clear sound? These are not standard things. You're only going to get them with the JBL Tour Pro 3, baby.
And I love the sound of JBL when it goes... These earbuds are packed with innovation because you can't stand out by following others.
Touchscreen smart charging case for one-touch control, instant EQ customization, true adaptive noise canceling, and the one-of-a-kind audio transmitter, which can plug and play with everything from game consoles to in-flight entertainment. What more could you want? First doesn't follow. Grab a pair at JBL.com.
Okay, only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first... There, the last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.
There are some people in the world of Formula One that everyone wants on their team.
I think Adrian's a unicorn. He's a very special, maybe exists once.
That's how Lawrence Stroll described Adrian Newey here on F1 Beyond the Grid in 2020. 5 years later...
Adrian Newey will be joining us as our technical managing partner of our Formula One team.
So, is Newey's arrival the final piece of Stroll's master plan to make Aston Martin world champions? When will the legendary designer's impact be felt? And how does all this affect Fernando Alonso's future? These are just some of the big questions going into the new Formula One season. So here on F1 Beyond the Grid, we're searching through the archives to find some answers. I'm Tom Clarkson, and in this show, we'll take you inside the mind of Adrian Newey. We'll ask Fernando Alonso about the likelihood of a return to the top step. And we'll find out what Lance Stroll's relationship with his father is really like. Lawrence Stroll bought the Force India team after they went into administration in the summer of 2018. They rebranded as Racing Point for two seasons before Lawrence purchased a substantial stake in the Aston Martin road car company, Aston Martin Lagonda, and brought the brand back to Formula One in 2021. Although their name may have changed a couple of times, Stroll's plan for the team has always been the same, to become the best racing team in the world.
There's several pieces to that plan. One is recruiting the best people. Second is giving them the best tools and processes to be able to fight for world championship. And our case, tools and processes, is the brand new Aston Martin campus we're building, which is about 400,000 square feet. Nothing ever built like it before in Formula One. It'll be the state-of-the-art Formula One facility. We call it a campus because it'll be over three buildings. Brand new wind tunnel, first new wind tunnel since I think in 2004 in Formula One. And then we'll have a building in the center, which will be for wellness and restaurants. We're going to have a nursery to take care of people's children. So it's really tools that would be needed to be fighting for world championships.
Have you enjoyed that process? Was it a blank sheet of paper? Right, lads, what do we need?
Yeah, well, it's a process that we started before COVID. We had to put it on hold for close to 2 years because of COVID. But it's been a team process. It's everybody involved in the team of, you know, in their departments, department heads of what they needed in terms of premises and people in order to be fighting for the top. So it's been a fantastic experience and it is very exciting.
Does Aston Martin have to win the world title to be regarded a success, the Formula One program to be regarded as a success?
No, it doesn't have to win a world title. It has to be fighting and contending for world championships. Winning would be the icing on the cake, but it has to have the ability every weekend to be able to win.
Such is the vagaries of sport, really, isn't it?
It's like every business I've ever run in my life. I have a great track record of winning at everything I've done. There's nothing closer to my heart that I'm more passionate about than this business. And for me, winning here doesn't necessarily mean winning the world champion, but means have a winning team that's capable each weekend of winning the race.
Interesting that you do refer to it as a business, not a sport.
Well, it is a business. There's been hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds invested. So it's a very large business. It's a very large business that has 750 to 800 employees. There's a road car side of it with a couple thousand employees. So it's an extremely large business.
Is it a sport for 2 hours on a Sunday afternoon?
Of course it's a sport, but a sport is a business, just as a football team is a business or a hockey team is a business. They're both.
People say that this is unlike any other business. Now, you're an incredibly successful businessman. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes.
And have you had to adjust your modus operandi for Formula One?
Not really adjust the modus operandi. It's not dissimilar to any other business, that it's teamwork. And it's all about, you know, why I've been so successful in my history and my track record is part of it is surrounding myself with the best people in every business that I've owned. And that's exactly the same as implementing that here in Formula One, particularly because there's even more people and more teamwork involved here. So it's really about teamwork. You win as a team, and the expression goes, you lose as a team. So I find that even more relevant in Formula One.
Have you always wanted to own a team?
No.
Wasn't a sort of boyhood dream?
No.
When did it become a...
When Force India went into administration.
Not prior to that?
Not prior to that. Never thought of owning a team. When Force India went into administration, I always recognized or believed that a Formula One team should one day have a very large value, like an NFL football team or a UK football club or what have you. And why it hadn't is because of the unleveled playing field with no budget caps. You had a few teams outspending the others, and basically that's why they were winning. What caught my attention with the Force India administration was this was a team that was 2 or 3 years, if you count the year of the administration, in fourth place with a fraction of the budget, a fraction of the headcount of the top teams. So it showed that the human capital of these, at the time, 400 people, in the famous expression, punching above their weight, really did. They did more with less. You know, they were fourth. The teams that were fifth, sixth, seventh had significantly higher budgets and a lot more headcount, and yet this team was able to be, again, punching above its weight. So I said to myself, with the right leadership and vision, which I can bring, the right finances, which I can bring, there's a strong possibility to take this team to be one day fighting for championships. In addition, though, simultaneously, it was with the acquisition of Liberty. Because with the acquisition of Liberty and then putting the budget caps into place and the more fair cash distribution for the how it's divided between the 10 teams made me check two boxes. So here I checked the box. It was a team with several years in fourth with the right leadership, vision, financing, etc. Could be more. And the field is now leveled with the budget cap. So I can't be outspent any longer. And every year going forward, that will be more relevant because the history will, time will pass and, you know, everyone will have a similar headcount and identical budgets. And then it's about who's doing a better job. And we already, you know, proved that this team could do a better job with basically less than the others. So it was the combination of, if this would have been a team tooling around the 9th or 10th place, I would have never bought it. I would never entered the administration process. I would have no interest because I know what it takes to take a team from 10th. And that's not what I would have signed up for. But it was a combination of the two. One without the other wouldn't have done it. To buy a team, no, I can't as an individual spend what Mercedes-Benz or Red Bull, it's a marketing fizzy drink budget, or as an individual, it's very hard to compete with large corporations. But now this individual can match those large corporations with the budget cap in place.
So timing is everything.
In that respect, yes. I wouldn't have bought it without those two stars aligning.
And has that been something that's been the case throughout your career?
All the other brands I kind of started from scratch. They had been in business for years, but were significantly much smaller businesses that I grew to very, very large businesses by great vision, by great luck, and by surrounding myself with the best people in the business.
Lawrence, you strike me as a very passionate man, a force of nature, Are they accurate descriptions?
I've been referred to that once or twice, both those.
In fact, Checo Perez once described you as the most motivated person in the garage. Is that fair?
We have a lot of motivated people in the garage, so I'm not sure, but passionate, yes, very.
And with Lance being a racing driver, obviously you in charge of the team. Is Formula One now the family business?
Well, it's my business. That is, you know, we have other family businesses, not at all relevant or in scale or size to the investment we have today based on Formula One and Aston Martin, the brand. You know, I'm the executive chairman and the largest shareholder of Aston Martin Lagonda, the road car company. So the combination of the two are very significant and largest investment that the family has today, yes.
Well, you've explained where you want the team to be in 5 years' time, which is challenging for world championships. What about Aston Martin Lagonda? Where do you want that in 5 years' time?
We have very clear plans. I've already been executive chairman now for about 20 months, and happily to say that when I first looked and did my due diligence at Aston Martin, I saw a car company that had probably arguably the most beautiful cars in the world, a 108-year-old iconic institution that the British, and I've really seen since taking over the company, the British have the pride and feel that they own Aston Martin. It's though it's owned by the country. It's unbelievable. And, you know, when we change from Racing Point to Aston Martin, the level of letters for recruitment, for applications, there were so many in the industry that it's been overwhelming. I had no idea the power of this brand, and it really is the power of the brand. You know, we signed hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of sponsorship before we even had a car painted because of the power of the brand. People want to be associated with this premium luxury 108-year-old brand, and the same with people, the letters we've received from people working for our competitors saying we want to be part of the journey to bring Aston Martin to World Championship. It's our pride, it's British. So it's blown me away, truly blown me away, the power that this brand, particularly in the UK.
So when are you going to be ready, Lawrence?
We clearly need these facilities. We're still operating out of what was Eddie Jordan's place, which you can imagine the challenges. 2 or 3 years ago. We need these new facilities to provide, I said, the tools and the processes. We're going to have our own wind tunnel. You know what that means for a Formula One team. It's dramatic. A lot of technologies happened between the last one being built in 2004 and today. I'm realistic. We need the right time, without pressure, to put together the right team of people. And with now Aston Martin's association by brand, we are attracting. Because of my passion, my track record, the name and the brand Aston Martin, again, the facilities we're building. So we need it all to come together. And then, you know, it's a question of time. It's like building any business. The other company I've owned took 5 to 7 years to start to get it all right. And then from 7 to 10 years, you grow stronger and stronger. So, you know, famous expression, Rome wasn't built in a day. There's no business built in a day. Formula One team, no different than any other business. You got to hire all the right people and they got to do a good job.
Certainly do. So, Lawrence, just to end, what would it mean to you to win a race as Aston Martin?
We won a race last year as Racing Point. It would mean more because of my association now and ownership of Aston Martin Lagonda. And I have no doubt we will win many races. And I'm looking forward for that day to come.
And what would it mean to you to win the world title?
I think it would mean as much to me as maybe a little more to me, I was going to say, than anybody else who owns a team because of the association that I have with the brand of having both the road car company and the Formula One team.
Would that be the greatest achievement of your life?
Yes, I think that would be fair.
Okay, only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first, there, the last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.
You know those cravings that hit you out of nowhere? charred steak tacos, silky mushroom risotto, or a perfect summer salad. When the craving hits, Cookunity delivers, made with real ingredients and no shortcuts. Get ready to eat meals delivered directly to your door, all tailored to your lifestyle, dietary needs, and cravings. Get what you're craving. Go to cookunity.com/crave or enter crave before checkout for free premium meals for life. That's cookunity.com/crave.
Winning the world title would be the greatest achievement of Lawrence's life. Those are strong words. And he stayed true to his word because the campus at Silverstone is now a sensational facility. It has the latest of everything all laid out in a logical Formula One way. And Adrian Newey starts work at the Silverstone-based team this week. He's regarded by many as the greatest F1 designer of all time. His cars have won 26 world championships across stints at Williams, McLaren, and Red Bull. And in 2023, when the RB20 he designed won 22 out of 23 races in a record-shattering year for Red Bull, Adrian took us on a fascinating journey inside his genius mind, sharing his thought processes when he's designing cars and explaining where his competitiveness comes from.
When I was at school, then I was kind of, I suppose, always thought about things a bit differently. One example that's always stuck in my head is that kind of when I was, I don't know, about 12 or so, we had a lesson on friction. And it was actually a video. And it went through the sort of what friction does, how it works, etc. And at the end of it, the teacher said, so everybody, is friction a good thing? And I was the only one who stuck up my hand and said, well, without friction, we'd all fall over. We wouldn't be able to stand up because we'd just slide around everywhere. And everybody laughed and the teacher laughed at me. And I thought, well, that's a bit unfair because I think I actually have a reasonable point. And it's a silly little example, but it made me, I think, feel as if I needed to prove myself. And feeling you need to prove yourself is in truth a close cousin to being competitive.
Do you think you still need to prove yourself after all this success?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been lucky enough to have a very successful career, but I don't really look back particularly. I'm not a statistic counter. I just enjoy being in it. Ever since I was about 10 or even younger, then my ambition was to be a designer in motor racing. And when I got my first job in motor racing at Fittipaldi, a little team Fittipaldi's in Reading, and actually got to the end of the first month, and I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I was fresh out of university, joined as junior aerodynamicist, which turned out to be senior aerodynamicist. Teams in those days were so tiny that they had no aerodynamics team. I was it. But anyway, I got to the end of the first month, had no idea what I was doing, as I said, and got a salary for it, and I thought, or a paycheck, and I thought, this is amazing. Here I am. In motor racing, complete numpty, but I'm getting paid. This is fabulous. And really, I can say pretty much, I mean, it's the odd day, of course, that I haven't enjoyed, but pretty much every day has been a bonus and a treat.
Your dad was a veterinary surgeon. Were you ever tempted to follow him in medicine and that aspect of science?
No, not really. I mean, I love going on sort of farm visits with him. I kind of sit on his knee when I was about 6 and do the steering while he did the pedals, that sort of thing. And then occasionally when I was kind of a little bit older, into my very early teens, then if there's an operation at the weekend and the surgery nurses weren't around, then I would help him with the operation. But I think the bit of my dad's...
How good were your stitches?
I definitely wasn't doing any stitching. I was handing the utensils and trying not to faint. But the bit of my dad's makeup or interest that did definitely rub off was he was a huge car enthusiast. So he had Mini Cooper S's and then Lotus Elans and so forth. And he used to enjoy tinkering with them and modifying them and so forth. Had a small workshop in the garden, which had a lathe and basic metalworking equipment and welding equipment and so forth. And using that workshop, I think, was probably quite key to me. So when I was about 8 to 10, then I'd buy these Tamiya 12 scale models. The first one was a 1967 Surtees Honda, and then the second one was a Hill Lotus. And those 12 scale models were great, actually, because all the parts are labelled, front upright or front top wishbone or whatever. So you got the terminology. In assembling them, you started to understand how the chassis side of the car works in terms of suspension articulated, and it's a monocoque that bolts for an engine that bolts for a gearbox, that sort of thing. But by the time I was about 11, I started to become bored with building effectively other people's designs. So I started sketching designs of my own, or my own designs, and then used my dad's workshop to make the fold up bits of aluminium and make bits of fiberglass and so forth to create these 12 scale models. The bits I couldn't make, like the tires and engine, really, I would sort of cannibalize off the old models. But I think the key part of that is there's this old thing, is it the 5,000 hour rule, that to become
10,000 hours.
10,000.
Yeah,
sorry.
Harder than that.
Harder than that. I probably exceeded those 10,000 hours in those sort of long, boring summer holidays, where I would kind of, as I say, sketch away and then make it. And whilst, of course, I had absolutely no idea what I was doing, I think the practice of sketching and then turning that into a 3D object was great practice from a very young age.
So you go to university in Southampton. There were Formula One teams using the wind tunnel there. Why a degree in aeronautics and astronautics and not mechanical engineering?
Simply that I figured that racing cars were closer to aircraft than
But that was
to
quite forward
else.
Thinking at the time.
Yeah, that would have been 1977. So I suppose in hindsight, maybe it was, but you know, I'd avidly read every magazine I could find that had anything vaguely technical in it. Visited a few races, particularly Mallory Park, which was close to where I went to school, and that was a great little paddock because you could walk around and watch look at all the F2 cars and 5000s and so forth.
What impact did that have on you, going to Mallory and seeing the cars for real?
Huge, because you know, in those days there wasn't actually a lot of television. Or coverage of motor races. So actually seeing the cars, hearing them, smelling them, looking at them in great detail, and, you know, the paddock was completely open. Nobody minded this spotty-nosed little kid kind of poking around. And in fact, the opposite. A lot of them would actually kind of explain what they were doing and so on and so forth. So that was without doubt key, combined with my attempts to go karting, which my dad was quite tough. Said I'd love to go karting, so we went along to the local kart track, Shennington, and he made the very accurate observation that, as far as he could see, a lot of the kids were there not because they were really passionate about it, but because their dads were, and it was their dads leading their childhood vocationally, or whatever the phrase is. So anyway, he said, well, look, if you want to go karting, you're going to have to buy your own kart. I'll double your money, i.e. for every pound I earned, he would put a pound in. So kind of washing cars and doing the newspaper rounds and picking plums and from the orchard and selling them outside the veterinary practice and that sort of thing, earned a bit, but not even doubled it, didn't earn very much. Anyway, the bottom line is I bought this very old, tired old car with a Villiers engine in it and tried racing it. And combination of it and me was absolutely hopeless.
Really? I mean, are you being modest?
No, I'm not. It was kind of back of the grid stuff. It wasn't actually the driving that really interested me. It was how to make the cart go faster. So I then took myself on a welding course at BOC, British Oxygen, in North Birmingham, which was a kind of a hour's bus ride from Stratford, where I grew up. And I was about 15 when I did it, so I got a bit of peer pressure from all the other guys who were on the course, and because I actually, for whatever reason, turned out to be reasonably good at it, welding and brazing, and became kind of the lecturer's pet for that 2-week course. I got a bit of flack, which was actually also a good lesson, because it kind of made me start to learn how to fit in. I developed my Brummie accent, which was quite easy, but it's back to, I think, the combination of going to Mallory Park, Alton Park, the karting. It just all helped to develop me, and so also to understand that I needed to get to university, which suffered a bit of a setback when I got chucked out of school at 16. I went to this very Dickensian public school, which, I'll be honest, I absolutely hated from every single day there.
What aspects of it did you hate? Was it being away from home?
A little bit away from home, but yeah, perhaps I was a bit homesick for sure. But I think the key thing for me was I wasn't terribly sporty. I was pretty average at sport. In looking back, I didn't particularly recognise it at the time, but I probably, as I mentioned earlier, do look at things a bit differently. And that didn't make me terribly popular. So I had one or two friends, but not many. Got bullied a bit, usual thing. I don't know, just I couldn't engage in my hobbies particularly, although actually the workshop manager was very good, and he used to take my cart up there and work on it during the term time. I ran it around the chapel. There's a sort of load of paths around the chapel. And I thought, okay, let's just run it around and make sure it works. And of course, being a two-stroke, it made a hell of a racket. And so pretty soon the whole school turned up to watch me going around in this thing, which then got shut down. And unfortunately, the poor old workshop manager got quite a telling off from the headmaster for it. yeah, just didn't fit in. And so when I met my demise after O-levels, then, well, what's now called GCSEs.
Can I ask, how were your O-levels? Were they good? Were they bad?
I was pretty good academically. Yeah, no, I was okay. I was actually better at the arts than I was at the sciences, if anything. And so the careers advisor at school said that I should take art, which I was pretty good at art. Sorry, sounds not very modest, is it? But I was okay at my art.
I've read people referring to you as the Michelangelo of Formula One.
I'm definitely not that bad. But so recommendations are English and history, and fine, but I had no interest in doing art, English and history. I was completely single-minded at that point of wanting to be a working motor racing as a designer.
It is extraordinary how early in your life you knew that this is what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
Given that there was no motor racing in the family.
No, I was very lucky, to be perfectly honest, because, you know, obviously for most people, it takes them a long time to find their vocation. But for whatever reason, I think with me, it just clicked from that very young age.
Can we talk about the drawing board, right? Famously, you still use a drawing board when CAD is ubiquitous in Formula One. What are the advantages of the board, the pen and paper, if you like?
That I'm a dinosaur and it suits me.
No, but it's extraordinary how you still use that, and yet you are still so current as well.
For me, it's CAD or a drawing board. It's a way of getting ideas in your head down into a medium that can be developed from. Typically, I will nowadays, of course, if it's aerodynamic, I'll look at the CFD, the computational fluid dynamics, which is aerodynamics on computer, which is an amazing tool that really didn't reach maturity in Formula One until late 90s. So I will kind of look at the CFD. I'll sketch from that. Sketch some ideas, working with my colleagues, of course, and then draw something. Now, I've used a drawing board because, to me, it's the language that I'm most comfortable and most fluent in. If I tried to use a CAD, I feel I would never be as fluent in it. I will spend too much time thinking about how to operate it and not just drawing naturally, if you like, subconsciously. The drawing bit has to be subconscious now, or for me it does. And I think CAD is now, if I watch the guys in those sort of early years of CAD, which, again, CAD came in properly somewhere around the mid-90s, early to mid-90s in Formula One, those early CAD systems were quite mechanical. People used to have to concentrate a lot on trying to get it into the system. Of course, now those systems are developed, and the guys who are fluent in it can, if you like, draw subconsciously in the way that I can. The drawing is not the part that is loading them. I'm never going to achieve that. And to me, it actually doesn't matter. I've become, through years of practice, I can, and this probably stems actually back to those formative years of sketching models and then making them. I seem to have quite a good ability to be able to visualize something in 3D and then put it down onto paper in 2D. Whereas the CAD system, of course, does free you of that. You don't have to go through the 2D, but you can start straight in 3D.
Did you try and get the hang of CAD?
I did briefly in my kind of gap 6 months or so between leaving Williams and joining McLaren, then I did go on a CAD course, and it just didn't come naturally. So I gave up on it, I'm afraid.
Now, look, the tools at your disposal have changed hugely over the years, but what about your thought process when you're designing a new car? Is that the same as when you started?
Yes, it is. I think the inputs are more thorough and better understood than when I started. So if I think back to when I started designing the Indy cars in kind of 84, your knowledge on which to base a new design was not as well informed as it is today, because the teams are much smaller, but more importantly, we didn't have the tools that we have today. The people often ask, what's the biggest revolution that I've seen in Formula or in motor racing through the years? It has to be computing power and the simulation tools that run off the back of that, because it's that that allows a much more thorough understanding of the car.
But where does the process start? You obviously look at the rule book first, and then what's the first thing you're looking at when you're designing a car? Is it the position of the power unit? Is it the wheelbase?
The big rule change that we had at the start of last year, which I think you can easily argue is the biggest single rule change we had since Venturi cars got banned at the end of 1982, I think it was. Then that was, sitting down with the rule book, as you say, then trying to understand what architecture, in terms of where do you put the front wheels, where do you put the rear wheels relative to the fixed bits of the series of sort of chassis, engine, gearbox, underlying architecture you have to decide. And then from that, starting, in my case, what I concentrated on was that architecture, and then the front and rear suspension, because they're kind of key bits that you want to try and get right if you possibly can. If you get the bodywork wrong, within reason, you can change it during a season. But if you get the underlying architecture wrong, at the very least, you're stuck with it for one season.
When Adrian announced his departure from Red Bull in May 2024, there was lots of speculation that he'd join Lewis Hamilton at Ferrari this season. I did actually ask Adrian during that chat a couple of years ago whether he regretted not having Ferrari on his CV.
Emotionally, I guess to a point, yes. But just as, for instance, working with Fernando or Lewis would have been fabulous, but it never happened. It's just circumstance. Sometimes that's the way it is.
Well, Adrian will finally get the chance to work with two-time world champion Fernando Alonso, who has shown he still has what it takes to compete at the very highest level, with 8 podiums since he joined Aston in 2023. Race win number 33 and title win number 3 have eluded him so far, but who knows what he could achieve in a car designed by Adrian Newey. Either way, Fernando is clearly enjoying his time at Aston and excited for this next chapter.
I would say that now in Aston, it's a very happy place for me. I have a great relationship with Lance, with Lawrence, and I have a great admiration for Lawrence as well. You know, he has a passion for racing. You can see Lawrence from the outside, you know, a strong man, you know, and a big character, and not maybe too nice, you know, with you. It's intimidating, but it's total the opposite. He's an incredible leader for all of us, and his determination, commitment, and passion for racing, I never saw in anyone else.
So there's a softer side.
There is something. You need to know him, and you need to be in the circle of confidence. But yeah, he's a great leader. And he has so much success in life, I think, because he's a great leader.
Well, let's talk about Adrian Newey now. Is he the final cog in the wheel? Do you feel this team now has everything it needs to produce at least a championship challenging car?
I do believe so. I don't think that we are missing anything. I think for me, the only thing that we are missing and we are not up to speed is just time. You know, this team is so new. If you compare to any other title contender, we are just 3-4 years old, you know, the team. So naturally, we have to learn through mistakes. We have to take some lessons from mistakes that we will do. And this is the only thing that is missing or we will face in the next few years, which at the same time is my biggest enemy, because I don't have that time, you know, to go through that process of making mistakes and learn from those. But I'm relaxed about that. I will do my best. And I think with Adrian, now the team has all the ingredients, especially the wind tunnel. And Adrian were the two biggest, or the two things that we missed more in the last two seasons. Wind tunnel, having our own wind tunnel in-house where you can produce a part, test it, analyze it, maybe come back tomorrow. We don't have now. We are just using the Mercedes wind tunnel when we are allowed to use it. In their time, they tell us, and you know, this is what we have. And this is a this is going to be a game changer for the team. And then Adrian, you know, is just the man producing the fastest cars in the world. Plus, I think he will be a great leader, you know, for a lot of young people we have.
I know you were chatting to him in the back of the car at Spa Airport all those years ago, but now you've been able to chat to Adrian properly. Do you find him stimulating? Are you quite similar in your approaches to the sport?
I think I don't know well enough Adrian to know when he's motivated or less motivated or in which state of mind he is now for the project. But I think listening to him and I think the knowledge that he has about motor racing is enough to make a difference on any organization. And for us, for sure, it's going to be like that. He can see things by the first look that it will take 1 month for a group of very clever people to spot that, you know. And this is priceless in Formula One because the race is next week. We don't have 1 year to analyze a thing. So I think that magic will be incredible to witness. So it's not a professional adventure that I'm in now in Aston Martin. It's a personal adventure that I'm so looking forward to have lunch with him, to sit with him in a meeting room or in a race weekend in an airport, taking a flight together, talk about the race, about you know the plans and things like that will be so much or so rewarding for me personally as well, you know, to learn from a man like him.
Clearly, it's all about 2026 with the rule changes. But do you think he can influence 25? Because it's going to be so close and his sort of holistic view of how to go racing and how to set up a car will help, right?
I would like to say yes, but if I'm honest, I'm 99.9 or 100% he cannot do much for 2025, unfortunately for us. But I think he will join in March 25. I think the focus will be so much in 26 because the change of regulations. There is the cost cap. There are a lot of limitations that we cannot have two programs, two separate programs on 25 campaign and 26. And actually, being honest, the 2025 is unlikely that we fight for big things. If we see now 24, how things are going, top four teams, big gap, the rest of the teams, I don't think that anyone can close that gap next winter. So I don't think that it changes so much for us to be fifth in the championship in 25 or sixth or fourth. And it changes a lot if in 26 we start with the right foot. So I think 2025, we have to deal ourselves without Adrian. And I think we are more than capable of doing so. But yeah, the biggest goal is 26. And I think he should focus on that.
You talk about closing the gap. The gap is not big. And I'm going to remind you that you were only, what, 0.2 off pole in Montreal this year? That's not a big gap
That's
to close.
That's not that.
But it's not a big gap to
I
close.
I remember only the worst races then. No, in qualifying, it's true that things are extremely close. Even in Q1, we see sometimes the first guy and the 16th is only 3 or 4 tenths. But I think it's just casuality and a mix of factors where the top teams, they don't push so much in Q1. They don't use too many set of tires. And the guys at the back, we need to do everything we can in Q1 to go through. So I think the gaps we normally look at are more in the races on Sundays. And on Sundays, we see that 50% of the times we get lap by the leader. And this is more than 1 second a lap. So if you want to close 1 second a lap in race day, it's a big, big thing.
Well, the Fernando Alonso I'm sitting opposite seems more energized, enthusiastic. Are you going to prolong your career now that you've got Adrian? And
I don't want to stress too much about that. I will lie if I tell you that I didn't think about it. Obviously, I will raise 25, 26. And then in 26, I think I will see how I feel, how motivated I am, and I will discuss it for sure with Lawrence and with Adrian eventually, what will be the best for the team. I have a long-term commitment with Aston. I will be working for Aston for many years, behind the wheel or in a different position. And as I said, because we enter in this personal adventure of working with a talent like Adrian, I want to experience that behind the wheel, yes, but I'm not too scared of working alongside somehow and seeing Aston winning even if I'm not behind the wheel. Because I will feel when I'm not ready to give something extra behind the wheel to the team, and maybe someone else can do a better job. And I will be very honest on that. And I will not be disconnected to the team. So I will feel if we win eventually, when I'm not driving, I will enjoy it a little bit as well.
Okay, only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first, there, the last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.
While Fernando and Adrian know what it takes to succeed at this level, at the heart of the Aston Martin project is a father and his son, Lawrence Stroll and his son Lance. They've been on this racing journey together since Lance was 6 years old. So when I caught up with Lance a few years back, I asked him what their relationship was really like.
I mean, I guess I know him pretty well. we've been through quite a bit together, you could say that. No, I mean, I have a great relationship with him away from the track, you know, as a dad and as a boss. So,
is it odd having him as a boss?
No, because he's a good boss. You know, he's been extremely successful in so many of his businesses. In the fashion industry and then whatever he's picked up, he's been successful at. And it's been the same in Formula One, you know, where we were this time last year as a team, even before this time last year, at the beginning of last year, and where we are now. It goes to show how much progression we've made as a team. And that's thanks to him guiding the ship. And it's thanks to the 500 very talented people that we have back at the factory that, you know, go to work and every day and get the job done.
Does he put a lot of pressure on you?
I think I put more pressure on him when he's watching the race from the sidelines. I mean, he's picked up a few gray hairs over the years.
Final lap, Lance Stroll on for his first ever podium. Valtteri Bottas, 1.3 seconds behind.
Huge pressure for the teenager in the Williams, but he looks rock solid.
Lance Stroll, has he been overtaken by Valtteri Bottas? Just on the line, Bottas gets second.
Oh man, he got me.
Unlucky. P3, mega drive.
I can remember Baku 2017 and seeing your dad stood below that podium. He was welling up. It was a special moment. And he really cares about your career, doesn't he? That's what came across in that moment. And you see it every step of the way. Do you almost feel like it's the two of you doing this together?
For sure. We've been on this journey together from the start and we're still on it. But yeah, I mean, no, he doesn't put pressure on me because he supports me when it, you know, through the hard times as much as the good times. And, you know, I think that's what family does. It's a bigger picture than just racing. It's a father and son journey. It's a family journey. Like I said, we've all been on it together, and he's had my back through the highs and through the lows. And, you know, that says it all.
Do you share any other hobbies away from racing?
We got pretty competitive on the golf course sometimes. I give him a few strokes. But yeah, that's about it.
What's your handicap?
Oof. That's a tough question, Tom. Some days it's 100. Some days I play scratch.
But on a good day, varies, on a good day,
I like to think I'm around a 6-7. Yeah, when I'm playing well,
that's proper.
Like I said, that's a very loose handicap. Some days it's more like a 26, 27. So
yeah.
let's keep talking about racing.
In fact, do you and Dad share a passion for, is it the New York Giants and other sports away from F1?
Yeah, we watched the Giants. We actually went to two Super Bowls where they both won when I was young. I think it was 2007 and then 2012. We've always been big fans, and we were both Super Bowls, so that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that is very cool. Can we talk a little bit about your journey now? Journey from living in Canada, coming to Europe, and then the whole racing bug. Can you remember what made you want to get into a go-kart for the first time? How old were you? Six?
I was six, exactly. I was six the first time I got in a go-kart. And it all started because I was a little adrenaline junkie that was up for anything. And for my sixth birthday, my dad bought me a little go-kart. And we own a track up in Canada, outside of Montreal, a little place called Mont-Tremblant. And
there was an F1 race there back in the day, wasn't there?
I wasn't born, but maybe you were, Tom. No, <I'm
kidding. laughs> Thank you very much, Mr. Stroll.
No, you're not that old. You're not that old. I was far from born, though, on the other hand. Yeah, that was way before my time. So my dad bought me a little go-kart when I was six. And I was always very passionate about racing and stuff. We'd watch Formula One together, and it was running through the family. So... got my little go-kart at six. We set up some cones in the parking lot of the racetrack, and I drove around like all summer, just around the cones. And just, it was just a little go-kart with like four-stroke small engine. I was six, so it was really just the beginning. But that was the beginning of the end. And then I ended up here.
I love the fact that your first miles in a go-kart were at Mont-Tremblant. And it was like a lightning strike, was it, in terms of you just loved it and knew from that moment on?
Wow, that's a strong word, that I knew at 6 years old that I was going to be in Formula One. But I definitely got the bug. I got the racing bug, and it grew from there. It grew from there, 1 year at a time, and ended up here.
Well, at what point did racing change from being a hobby to an obsession?
That was probably when I moved to Europe with my family. I was 12, and we came over to Europe to compete, internationally in go-karts, because it was much more competitive. The first few years I raced in Canada, it's competitive, but if you want to compete against the best, you have to come to Europe, and that's where all the best drivers in the world from 12 years old onwards compete. So when we made that commitment, that's when it started to become more serious. But it was still, Formula One was still kind of in the distance, and I wasn't sure at 12 years old that I was going to be a Formula One driver. It was still a hobby. It was still fun. I mean, you can't take things too seriously at that age. When I was in Formula 3 and I was winning races, and yeah, I signed with Williams that year to be their like junior driver, I knew that there was an opportunity to go to Formula One, and that was kind of the big picture, yeah.
But was the main reason the family moved from Canada to Europe to support your racing career?
Yes, absolutely. It's thanks to my mom, my sister, everyone. Yeah, the whole family. I mean, without my sister willing to go to school in Europe and, supporting my dreams, I wouldn't be where I am today. Without my mom willing to do it, I wouldn't be where I am today. And without my dad, supporting me and helping me from day one, and being my, by my side, I wouldn't be here today. So it's everybody for sure. It's my whole family. They've all contributed, and they've all supported me and been there with me throughout the journey. And it's thanks to them that I am where I am today.
It's an incredible family commitment, isn't it? Now, there's the perception that you've had an easy ride getting here. Now, you're familiar with the stick people use to beat you, but what is your reaction to that? Commitment way beyond just Lance Stroll, isn't it?
For sure. I mean, I love it. I fuel off of it. I think...
What, the criticism?
For sure, for sure. If you don't fuel off the criticism, then you dwell on it and it eats you up inside. So I think I've learned to kind of embrace it and use it as like energy to prove people wrong. And I love that. I think that's powerful. You know, it's powerful to use it as fuel. But I've always said to myself, I'll just do my talking on the track. And it's always been like that since day one because of where I come from and my background. You know, there's a lot of people that I guess probably hope that I don't do so well and they hope that I fail. And that's okay, you know, everyone is entitled to have their own opinion. At the end of the day, I just do my talking on the track. And, you know, I won those championships leading up to Formula One, Formula Four, Formula Three. On the Toyota Racing Series in New Zealand.
Yeah, that's a decent CV.
And in Formula One, you know, I've been on the podium. I've, you know, been on pole and, I've had many good races. My consistency hasn't been the best. I'm aware of that. That's something that I'm still working on. In the last couple of years, I definitely think that my consistency can be better. And there was a year at Williams where I was in a pretty bad car. So that was a tough year for me. But, you know, I've proved as well in Formula One that, you know, I deserve to be here. And it's always going to be the same, I think. You know, I've recognized that. It's when you do bad, people start talking bad. And when you do well, everyone's right there. Everyone wants a piece of the pie. So it's all part of the circus.
What a quartet. An owner who puts his money where his mouth is. An incredible designer who will inspire the next generation of car for the team. And two fast drivers. Added to that, they now have former Mercedes engine boss Andy Cowell as team principal. So the ingredients and experience is in place for the team to move up the grid over the next couple of years. Links to the full versions of my chats with Lawrence, Adrian, Fernando and Lance are in the episode description. On Monday, you'll be able to listen to F1 Nation's preview of the 2025 season. And then we'll be back next Wednesday with the first guest of the new series of F1 Beyond the Grid. Thanks very much for listening. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audio Boom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
Okay, only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first... There, the last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.